coming here. I'm going to say a few comments, and then we're going to move the program along into the lunch speakers. My comments essentially are to thank everyone for coming. Some of you have traveled very long distance to talk about this issue. I personally believe that school choice is an issue without peer. That it is, in my opinion, without exaggeration, the single most important issue facing this nation right now. And I think it is that because it goes fundamentally to so many problems we see across our society. It goes fundamentally to what I see as the single greatest disgrace of this nation today, which is the condition of the elementary and secondary school education for many of the poor and disenfranchised in the inner cities in this country. This nation was built upon being a nation of opportunity. And our current system is failing to provide that opportunity. We are raising generation after generation of children who are trapped. Kids who are trapped in schools, not all of them, but many schools in the inner cities, many schools in the poorest neighborhoods, kids who are trapped with no hope and no way to get out. Kids who are trapped with no real prospect of getting an education, with no real prospect of escaping illiteracy, with no real prospect of ever having a chance to get anywhere out of the ghetto, with no real prospect of escaping the crime and violence that plague these neighborhoods. School choice, in my opinion, is the most important issue in the nation today because it cuts to the very core of all of the root causes of those problems. Because with an education, a child can do anything. With an education, a child can conquer any circumstance and any outside factors. And what school choice is all about is giving those kids that right now are facing a very bleak future, giving them a promise of hope. School choice, in my opinion, is not only incredibly important, it is also, I believe, incredibly simple. Incredibly simple to understand what it's about. I will never forget a story that was told me by a very good friend of mine who's active in litigating many of these school choice cases. She told me a story about a client of hers, a very large man, about 6'6", 280 pounds, who had his daughter in a school and was receiving a voucher to pay for her to go to school. And when a court shut that program down, her client looked at her and began to weep, openly weep. And he looked at her and asked one very simple question. Why? Why won't they let me send my little girl to school? That's what this issue is about. It isn't about a bunch of academics discussing interesting theories, intersecting in a hypothetical world of what the Platonic norm would be for the ideal education. It's about helping kids have a future. All someone has to do to understand school choice and to understand it in their belly is to think for a second what it would feel like to be in that situation. Think for a second what it would feel like. Most of the people in this room did not face that. But imagine for a second you're living in an inner city, and for whatever reason, you don't have a job, you don't have financial resources, but you do have a little girl. And the only place you can send her is the local school with a 60% dropout rate, with rampant illiteracy, with drug dealers in the hallway, with little girls being raped in the bathroom. That's what you're facing. I personally cannot imagine the hopelessness and desperation of a mother or father facing that situation with no place else to go. Now, the reason why most of the people in this room never face that, the reason why you don't see schools like that in middle and upper class neighborhoods, is if you did, there wouldn't be any kids in there. If there were a school in Bel Air, or in Greenwich, Connecticut, or in Bethesda, Maryland, where the kids were getting shot, where nobody was learning, nobody would send their kids there. Every single one of the parents would say, not with my little girl, not with my little boy, and they would exercise choice. They would pull out the oldest voucher in the world, which is their wallet, and they'd pay to send their kids somebody else. People all the time say, well, these voucher things, I don't understand them, they're confusing, they're complicated, will they work, what will happen? And they paint all sorts of apocalyptic pictures of a world with vouchers. But as I said, to my mind, vouchers are very simple, and we've seen them for a very long time. Because all vouchers are is giving the poor the identical choice the rich and middle class have always had. That's all vouchers are doing. It's saying to these poor parents, you have the same ability of choice that the comfortable family in Bethesda has. And if your kids are faced with a school that's not teaching them, where their life and their safety is in danger, you have the ability to do what every other parent with the financial wherewithal to do can and would do. Send your kids somewhere else. When you realize that, when you focus on the desperation of the children and the fact that vouchers give the parents and the kids a window of hope and opportunity out, all of the other arguments against vouchers, to my mind, crumble. Because it becomes fundamentally an issue of justice and what is right. An issue of we as a nation and a people making our promise of being a land of opportunity, making that promise a reality. The only way a voucher will have any effect at all is if individual parents and individual students decide they can get something better than what they've got today. You could give vouchers to every parent in a school, and if they were all happy with the school, nobody moves. The only way a voucher does anything is if those parents decide there's something better for my little boy, there's something better for my little girl. And unlike some that criticize voucher programs, I don't think those parents are ill-equipped to make that decision. I'm willing to trust the parents and the kids to do things to find the hope and opportunity for those kids. I don't think the parents of the poor are any stupider than rich parents or love their kids any less. And I think that if we can provide a system that gives them a way out, gives them a ticket to opportunity, we can change a myriad of social problems and act in the way that is true and right. A final observation. Even if it were not true that at its base and its core this was about justice and providing hope, even if we were to sit for just a moment and to engage in cold political calculus, school choice is an issue whose time has come. It is an issue with momentum behind it. It is an issue. Go to the inner cities, take a look at every survey that has been done of minority parents in the inner cities, the people facing these schools. The numbers are overwhelming. 70-80% support for school vouchers. The parents whose kids are going to these schools understand this problem. They don't have to be explained what the alternative is. They understand this problem. Those same voters, when asked, what is the most important issue you care about when you go to the ballot box? Those same parents say education. politically, this is the issue of the future. And right now, many of the politicians are not responding to that need. They're not responding to that need because the oft-referenced soccer moms are confused by and don't quite understand the relevance of this. Because after all, the public school in Bethesda is doing just great. So why are these people complaining and wanting some voucher thing? But when politicians and leaders realize that you have a situation where justice and fairness and equality converge with doing the politically smart thing, I believe school choice will be the issue for the ages. With those comments, I'd like to introduce Corey Swanson from the Stranahan National Issues Forum to welcome you all and to present an award to his dean.
It's a pleasure to have you all here. We're very pleased that everyone has turned out. As one of the co-founders of the Stranahan National Issues Forum, it's been my pleasure to work with Dean Quick since 1995. And Dean Quick has been exceptionally supportive of our program. His encouragement and guidance has helped the program become very successful. And Dean, as many of you know, Dean Quick will retire as Dean at the end of the year here. And the Stranahan National Issues Forum would like to recognize you with this plaque, which simply reads, the Stranahan National Issues Forum recognizes Dean Albert T. Quick for his strong commitment to establishing a diverse and supportive intellectual environment at the University of Toledo College of Law, 1995 to 1999. We want to thank you.
Sorry, I did not realize that was going to happen. I'm here to, of course, introduce the main speaker. So again, I will start off and say my name is Albert Quick, and I am Dean of the University of Toledo College of Law. I bring official welcome not only from the College of Law, of course, but also from the University of Toledo. We're delighted to see you all here. I had the opportunity to sit in on part of the panel just before lunch. I thought the level of debate and discussion at that panel was just excellent. So I'm sure that you're going to have the same type of great level of debate and discussion in the afternoon. You should look forward to a great conference. I have, of course, the distinct pleasure of introducing our luncheon speaker, Linda Chavez. And the New York Times, of course, called Linda Chavez, quote, an influential voice on civil rights policy. The Washington Post has described her as one of the, quote, new generation of intellectuals seeking to question the authority of civil rights establishment. This latter quote probably refers to Ms. Chavez's stance on bilingual education, maybe affirmative action in college admissions. As you know, Ms. Chavez is president of the Center for Equal Opportunity, which is based in Washington, D.C., and has previously held political positions, among them White House Director of Public Liaison, Director of the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights. She has, as you all know, a syndicated column that appears in newspapers across the country, has written for other publications such as the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, New Republic, and several other publications. She's written a prize-winning book, makes regular appearances on television and news shows. We are so delighted that she's able to come to Toledo today and to give this luncheon address. Please welcome Linda Chavez.
Thanks very much, Dean Quirk. It's a pleasure to be here in Toledo. I must tell you, I always have trouble getting to Toledo. Last time I came here was to speak to the Stranahan lecture series, and that time I got stranded in Cincinnati in a snowstorm. This time when I showed up at the airport yesterday, my plane was going to be so late getting into Cincinnati where I could then catch the trip here that I decided to stay home. So flew in this morning at the ungodly hour of 6:30 a.m. when I am usually fast asleep, so I hope I'm awake by now. But it is a pleasure to be here, and I must tell you that initially when I was invited to speak, I thought, well, you know, I don't talk on the subject of school choice. And in fact, for many years, I was somewhat of an agnostic on this subject, was not quite sure what my position was. Dean Quirk did not mention that among my previous employers was not only Ronald Reagan, but a man for whom I worked many, many more years, Al Shanker at the American Federation of Teachers. So I wasn't quite sure whether or not it made sense to come and talk about this. My issues, as the dean suggested, really center around race, language issues, and higher education, and I wasn't sure what I would have to contribute. Then I started thinking back on many of the debates that I've participated in over the last couple of years on the question of racial preferences in higher education and college admissions. And I realized that whether it was a debate or whether it was a lecture that I was giving, that at the end of the day, the debate always centered around what to do if you eliminate the current system of racial preferences in higher education. What is it you're going to do to open up opportunity and make our institutions of higher education not stratified by race? And when that subject comes up, I find myself arguing for opening up the education choices of Americans and eliminating the monopoly the public schools now have on the education of poor children in the United States, and at least considering going to either a voucher system or a tuition tax credit system or some system that allow parents once again to be the people who decide what is best for their children's education and pick the schools that their children attend, which of course, as Ted suggested, many parents in the United States already have that right. My children, by the way, went to the Bethesda Public Schools in Bethesda, Maryland. So I thought, well, I will come and talk to you about this, but I'm going to approach the subject of school vouchers through a back door, and I'm going to approach it by talking to you a little bit about what we at the Center for Equal Opportunity have found out over the last 3 years as we have conducted a series of studies on higher education admissions. Now, I've been debating the subject of quotas and racial preferences for virtually all of my adult life, going back to the early 1970s. And initially, when we would debate the subject of whether or not there was such a thing as racial preference in college admissions, I was frequently told by deans of admissions, by presidents of universities, by people who sat on the admissions boards, that in fact affirmative action in higher education did not amount to double standards, and that minority students were being admitted under the same standards as other students to the college, and that if there was any note given in terms of students' racial background, it was done in order to recognize that disadvantaged students might not have had equal preparation, and there might be some nod given in the direction of disadvantaged status, and that often coincided with race, but that race itself was not the deciding factor in admitting students, and that certainly there was no double standard in terms of the qualifications for admissions among students. And I was told this at a variety of colleges and universities around the country, and yet it, in fact, conflicted with what I was being told by groups of the faculty and by students themselves about what was going on. And so I decided that the only way to really get a handle on this and to settle this question was to begin to take a look at the issue and to try and amass some empirical evidence. And so, having started my political life on the left of center, I was very familiar with the tactics of the left, and something called the Freedom of Information Act was something that I was quite familiar that liberal organizations had used over the years to good effect. And I decided to go in under Freedom of Information laws in the various states and to request information about the admission of students from public colleges and universities in those states. And we now have a project going that has asked this kind of information from more than half of all of the states in the United States, and we have to date been able to publish studies in 8 states. We've looked at the admission practices of California, Colorado, North Carolina, Virginia, the state of Washington, and the two military academies, at Naval Academy and the Military Academy at West Point, and in Michigan. And those are the eight areas that we have so far published our data. And what we have found is that if you look at the qualifications of students who are admitted to these colleges and universities, there are very wide disparities, and those disparities are in fact correlated very highly with race. And that, for example, at the University of California at Berkeley, black students admitted come in with, on average, SAT scores that are more than 300 points lower than the average scores of white and Asian students admitted, and they come in with grades that are about a half a point lower. And we have found this kind of pattern in every state that we've studied, with some few exceptions for individual schools within states. For example, George Mason, University of Virginia, seemed not to have any evidence of racial preference in admissions there. We also conducted studies to see what the probability of being admitted was based on race, looking at hypothetically identical students, so same test scores, same grades, and having the only difference between them being race. And we found, for example, that at the University of Virginia, black student with identical grades and SAT scores would have a 45 times greater likelihood of being admitted than a white student or an Asian student would. At the University of Michigan and Ann Arbor, we found that similarly situated black and white students, a black student would have a 174 times greater likelihood of being admitted than an identically qualified white student. Well, it's clear, looking at this evidence, that schools are taking race into account, and they're doing it in order to meet the mandate of having a diverse student body, and they want to have a racial balance in their schools. They want to bring in more minority students. Now, some of us find that objectionable, just as a matter of policy, but we believe it is, with respect to state schools, constitutionally impermissible. That the 14th Amendment of the Constitution says you can't differentiate between people based on their skin color, and you cannot be preferring one group over another or one individual over another based on his or her racial or ethnic background. And in places like California, and most recently in the state of Washington, those of us who have favored race-neutral admissions have been successful in getting changes through the initiative project process to the state constitution. And so we now have a ban on that kind of racial preference of admissions in both California and in Washington. And through a slightly different process, through a court case, there is a similar ban now in effect in the Fifth Circuit, knocking down a program that used race and used different qualifications in the state of Texas. And we now have a couple of years of experience under the California program to take a look at what it means in terms of college admissions. And lo and behold, lots of people said it was going to mean huge change, the resegregation of higher education in California. And indeed, the early stories that came out of California with respect to what happened after the initiative passed and after the university regents began to change the admissions policies, and they determined that, in fact, there was a very large drop in terms of black and Latino admissions. Although the New York Times and the LA Times and all of the major papers in the country first reported a catastrophic drop, their figures came from only two of the campuses in the state, from the University of California, Berkeley, and UCLA. And it turned out a month or 6 weeks later, when the entire system released its data, there was indeed a drop of about 24% in overall black enrollment throughout the system. A much smaller drop of about 6% among Latino students. Nonetheless, it was clear that there were fewer black students and Latino students being admitted under these race-neutral standards. Well, now we are faced with a growing debate about whether this is good or bad as a matter of public policy. And if it is going to be the law of the land, if not nationally, at least in certain states, what can be done to try to increase those numbers? Because even those of us who are adamantly opposed to racial preferences are disturbed by the fact that there are 24% fewer black students in the University of California system. I don't think that's anything to be proud of. It's something to be concerned about and worried about. And so we're now faced with what to do about it. Well, the proponents of racial preference programs have come up with a variety of solutions to try to get around race neutrality in admissions and to try and increase those numbers. And one of the things that has been suggested recently, first in Texas and now in California, is simply to move away from such heavy reliance on test scores and grades and to go to a system where the university simply admits the top tier of students from its schools in the state. So that if you are in Texas and you are among the top 10% of your graduating class, whether that be in a private, parochial, or a public school, you will be guaranteed admission to the University of Texas. And there's a current proposal now being offered in California that would make it somewhat more elite. The top 4% of the graduating class of students in the state of California, but that you would be guaranteed admission. And a lot of people are looking at that and saying, gee, this is a good idea because, of course, it will increase the number of black and Latino students because we all know that education in the United States, in the public schools at least, is very concentrated by race and that black students are far more likely to go to school in majority black schools, Latino students in majority Latino students, and white students in majority white schools. And if we're just taking the top tier and going by the percentages, we will guarantee that there will be roughly a proportional number of black and Latino students because they're going to come from those black and Latino schools. And that will solve our dilemma. We will have a race-neutral system, and we'll get the requisite number of minorities, but we'll do it in a way that at least seemingly is race-neutral. Well, I've heard about these proposals and I've given them some thought, and I must tell you that my first reaction is that what this will do is precisely what the affirmative action programs of the 1960s and 1970s accomplished, and that is it will once again sweep under the rug the differences in the quality of education that exist in our inner city schools compared to the quality that exists in schools like the schools my children attended in Bethesda, Maryland. That it will simply allow for poorly performing inner city schools with majority black and Latino school populations to continue to graduate students, and so long as they graduate at the top of that very mediocre class, they'll be guaranteed a spot in higher education. But what will happen to them once they're in that higher education? And I venture to guess that 10 or 15 years ago from now, when I am about to go into retirement and I'm still doing my empirical studies of higher education in the United States, if I were to go back at that point and take a look at how those black and Latino students perform, they will continue to underperform their white peers in those higher education institutions, just as the beneficiaries of affirmative action today are underperforming their white and Asian peers in the schools they attend now. Because simply sweeping under the rug the failure to teach the basic skills that are necessary to succeed in higher education is exactly what we have been doing. So I don't see this as any kind of solution. I don't see trying to solve the problem of what we're going to do about the decline in minority students enrollment if we move to a race-neutral system is in any way going to fix the problem. And it comes back to what has been clear to me from the very beginning about affirmative action programs, and that is that they ignore the kind of skills gap that exists at the elementary and secondary school level. And that skills gap is not going to disappear so long as we have a monopoly system in which children who come from poor families have extraordinarily limited choice to attend only the school that is nearest their home and a state-supported school. So long as the public schools are insulated from the kind of competition that comes in a system where you have choices, I don't believe that we're going to see the change necessary to improve the quality of those public schools. And I say that as somebody who, for many years, worked as an advocate for public education, and who believes to this day that public education can be effective given the right circumstances. It was effective for my children. I don't believe that so long as there is not competition that you're going to do anything fundamental about the quality of education that Black and Latino students receive in the United States. And unless we open up that door to allowing for parents to make choices about which schools their children will attend, I don't see this as changing. And I look at it a little bit as I would competition in other areas. And I was reminded when Mr. Lawrence talked today about unions and the AFT's being willingness to look at technology, that one of the things I often used to hear Al Shanker bemoan, both publicly and privately, was the way in which some of his colleagues in the labor movement viewed technology and competition as a threat. It was one of the reasons I think Al Shanker was a more successful union leader than many of his colleagues in the labor union movement. And I think back in particular about what happened to Detroit. And I look back to the kinds of cars that Detroit was making in the 1970s that had become large, not particularly reliable gas guzzlers that were not, in fact, meeting the market demands of American drivers. And what happened when a few imports started to spill in? And what happened when Americans were suddenly given a choice of buying a cheaper, more reliable Japanese car compared with buying a car made by Americans? And in droves, Americans rushed to buy those Japanese cars. And of course, the UAW and other affiliated unions all bemoaned this. They resisted it. They condemned it. Supporters in the Congress would like to have stopped it by putting on various kinds of tariffs and eliminating free trade. But in fact, what happened was consumers continued to demand those Japanese imports, and what happened was Detroit decided that either they were going to have to compete and start to produce the kind of cars that Americans want to drive, or they were going to go out of business. They were going to go bankrupt. Well, I think the analogy is an analogy that works for education as well. I think if the public schools do have to compete with Catholic schools and other both sectarian and non-sectarian private schools for students, that is going to improve the quality of their product far better and far faster than any kind of mandated education reform that comes from Washington or comes from state capitals around the country. The competition in a free market system works to improve a product far better, far more efficiently than any kind of state regulation. Now, it is not just my concern about what happens in terms of higher education and the population of Black and Latino students who will one day be entering colleges and universities that brings me to support the notion of school vouchers. There is another population, a population that will increasingly be important to the future of the United States, and that population is a population of immigrants that are coming to the U.S. And with respect to the education of immigrants in the public schools, certainly with respect to the education of the single largest immigrant group now in our public schools, Latino children, those from immigrating from Latin America, the monopoly of public education has done more than simply produce a mediocre product, which is failing to teach them the skills they need in the math area and the reading area, etc. It is, in many school districts around the country, denying them what I consider a very basic right of any person living in the United States, and that is the right to learn how to read and write and speak English well. In fact, public education in the United States now mandates for Latino students in school districts around the country that these students, if they come into school with a language other than English as their first language, that these students will in fact be taught to read and write first in their native language. And for the most part, 80 to 90% of these programs are programs that affect Spanish-speaking children. These students are being denied the right to learn English in the public schools. Now, interestingly, public schools are not the only available education programs for immigrants, as they are as with other students. There are other alternative means, and because so many of the immigrant students who are coming into the United States now, particularly the Latinos, are in fact Catholic, many of those immigrant children are in fact going into Catholic education. Interestingly, Catholic schools do not have bilingual education programs. Catholic schools teach immigrant children by emphasizing English as a second language or using English immersion techniques. And clearly, since the parents of these children are in fact paying for their education, this is a choice that those parents are exercising. In the last year, the people in the state of California have had a chance to voice their opinion about language education and what is best for immigrant children, and they voted through the initiative process once again to adopt an initiative that bans bilingual education except for those parents who in fact request it. The system now is that if you have a child, as my child was when he entered the first grade, named Pablo Chavez Gersten, I got sent home a letter in Spanish informing me that he was going to go into a bilingual program. I was quickly on the telephone, and Pablo did not, in fact, end up in that program. But if I were a Linda Chavez Guatemalan housekeeper with a fourth grade education, the likelihood is Pablo would have been put into that bilingual program. I would not have understood my rights, and to this day, he would probably not be doing as well as he is. The system as it works in public schools now is that parents, although by law have the right to opt out of bilingual programs, most school districts deny them that right, deny the parents even knowledge of their right to remove the kids. And what the California initiative has done is simply to make teaching of English the norm, and for any parents who request bilingual education, make that the exception. So I see what happens to immigrant children and what happens to native-born Black and Latino children as one of the most important arguments for school vouchers and for opening up to competition the current public school monopoly on education. I think if we are going to be a nation that is truly a nation of equal opportunity for all, a nation in which your racial or class background does not in fact determine what your future is, that we have to make our education opportunities available the same one and to all. And that the only way that that is going to be feasible and workable is to end the kind of monopoly that we now have on public education and to allow parents to have a much stronger choice in being able to choose the schools that their children attend. Now, do I think that will be the end of public education in America? No, I don't. I think that there will be a lot of parents who, number one, opt in, as I did, living in Bethesda, Maryland. And there'll be some parents who will not take advantage of the opportunity to opt out of the system and whose children will remain behind in poorly performing public schools because they don't have the wherewithal to remove them. But I do believe that even if that means that some children get left behind and that not everyone takes advantage of the opportunity, that the quality of education will in fact be enhanced and improved by the competition that public schools will certainly have to face in terms of competing for students. And I believe that that will allow America's poorest Black and Latino students to be able to exercise the rights and the privileges that today accrue only to those who are middle class and largely white. Thank you very much. Open it up to questions. Yes.
When you were citing the statistics of the decline in African American and Latino enrollment, how are those statistics normed? Are they basically on percentage of population before those people groups, or was it based on what was the population the year prior?
It was what was the population the year prior. Under Proposition 209, which was enacted in 1996, it outlawed the use of race as racial preference in college admissions, and the university regions also adopted their own procedure, which essentially eliminated their racial preference programs. And what these statistics I cited show is the drop the first year the universities moved to a race-neutral standard. I should, by the way, emphasize that when you look at the entire University of California system, although there was that 24% decline among Blacks and 6% among Latinos, it was not evenly distributed. The largest gap, the largest decline was at Berkeley and at UCLA. And there were actually three of the eight universities in the system actually had double-digit increases in the number of Black and Latino students. Riverside, Santa Cruz, and Irvine, I believe, was the third.
Would that tend to show then that instead of choosing those universities, they simply chose another university? So they didn't go out of the system, they just went elsewhere.
Well, I would assume that because there was an overall, there wasn't an absolute decline in 24% Blacks, that they obviously did go out of the system. They may have gone to other schools in California. They may have ended up in the state college system. California has a very heavily tiered system, with the university system being at the top tier, then the state colleges, and then there are community colleges. There is basically an institution of higher education for anybody who graduates high school in California. There is a place somewhere in the system. The problem in the old racial preference admissions was that there was a lot of mismatching that went on. And when we did our studies, one of the things we looked at was not just who got in, but who graduated. And we found that they matched almost perfectly. The larger the gap in SAT scores and grades between Black and white students, the larger the gap in graduation rates between Black and white students. So they were very, very highly correlated. You know, there may have been other factors besides under preparation, but they certainly were correlated with those differences in preparation. Yes?
I wonder why there's no talk of trying to improve public schools or the neighborhoods. Using your automotive analogy, we all know that with government help, Lee Iacocca was able to turn around Chrysler, and look what it's become today.
It's become a Mercedes-Benz.
Why is there no talk of improving public schools?
Well, first of all, I think there has been a lot of talk about improving public education. In fact, the Republicans are right now in a contest with the Democrats to see who can spend more on public education in terms of federal spending. The amount of money that has gone into public education over the last 30 years has increased dramatically. At the same time that the money was going up, the scores were declining. I'm not going to suggest that there's a cause and effect there, but I will tell you that the reverse is not true either. It is not simply true that you can pour more money into the schools and expect a better product. I mean, the reasons for the decline in public schools are many and varied, and they are not all the fault of the teachers' union. I will be first to say a great deal of what's wrong has to do with some very important changes that have taken place in the family in inner cities. When you have a decline in family, we have children coming increasingly from single-family homes, when you have neighborhoods that are drug-ridden, this is going to have an impact on the schools. You also have a lot of mandates coming down to the schools that have nothing to do with the basic mission of education. When you have schools now being forced to provide for the nutrition needs, the medical needs, the psychological needs, not to mention the need to indoctrinate in certain politically correct ideologies, that's a lot less time to teach reading and writing and arithmetic. And so there are a lot of reasons why the quality of public schools has declined. But I would venture to say that the only way you're going to see an increase in that quality is to open them up to competition. Michael.
I thought that California Proposition 209 stood for the proposition of abolishing race and sex consideration in terms of admission in education. And in moving towards both the race and sex line policy. If that's the case, how do you explain these simultaneous movement in California to establish new public schools for girls only?
Well, you and I disagree on this subject, Michael, as you well know. I actually think there are big differences between segregating on the basis of race and segregating on the basis of sex.
I'm talking about 209.
Well, 209 does not, all 209 says is there shall be no discrimination or preference on the basis of race or sex. And I don't know how they're getting around that, because obviously we have the Brown decision that says separate but equal, separate can never be equal. And so since 209 mentioned sex, I don't know how they're getting around that. I will tell you that one of the questions I'm frequently asked in terms of the studies that we do is, why don't you look at sex in terms of differentials and whether there's any, whether there really is affirmative action with respect to sex going on in higher education institutions. It's clear that there are probably some departments that are affected by it, and they're probably in graduate schools, there may be some affirmative action programs in which is sexual preference given to females. In some programs. At the undergraduate level, we did actually begin to ask those statistics, and we found that when we started getting them, that there were no differences, and so we quit. We quit looking at the question. Yes?
One of our earlier panelists, Mr. Minsberg, was talking about how with the advent of ALCAS, what we could expect to see is more government requirements, accountability in the private schools, in the religious schools. Are you concerned, or should people who have their children in private schools or who support vouchers be concerned that bilingual education requirements would be extended to the Catholic schools?
Well, I think you specifically mentioned that as a possibility. Yes, I am concerned about that. I'll be very frank with you about that. It's always seemed to me the best argument against having vouchers or some other form, direct or indirect, of government aid to private and parochial schools. I can remember, I'm old enough to have gone to school in the 1950s when the whole question of religion and religious funding of religious schools first began to be litigated through the courts, and I can remember the nuns in my school, you know, arguing very forcefully against state aid to Catholic schools because they'd come in and make us adopt public school textbooks, and they were very concerned about that. So I do think it's a legitimate issue. I think it's something that has to be considered. I've seen, you know, I liked Gene Volokh's little diagrams of the way in which education is not very different from some of these other indirect subsidies to religious institutions, and he mentioned welfare. Well, in fact, in San Francisco, the Archdiocese has, in fact, been forced to change some of its hiring practices in order to participate in some programs in which it receives assistance. So this is a concern to me. I don't think it is something that those of us who care about these issues should, again, sweep under the rug. I think it's a legitimate issue. It's one we have to grapple with. But I balance it with the question of, you know, the crisis we have in public education today and what I consider the very unequal educational opportunities of Black and Latino kids in America. And I say it's an experiment that we ought to at least try. And we ought to see. And we can go slowly, and it can begin as it has in many places as an experimental program. But it's something I think that at this point is worth trying. Yes?
Lily, there's been a lot of talk about markets and competition here already this morning. There'll be more this afternoon. You made the analogy to the automobile market. So you also seem to be someone who's very kind of merit-based in terms of what you think should happen. What I don't quite understand, this is not a facetious question, you're also an expert on higher education. Why is it why screw around with vouchers at all? Why don't you just simply say that education in the United States should be as higher education is, more or less privatized?
I think that's actually would be the best solution. It might actually get around some of the questions.
And get around
regulation.
All these questions.
Right, and get around the regulation question.
Get around
the constitutional
question. Just privatize the whole bit.
I mean, make it essentially, and then you could, in fact, you know, if you were concerned about people not being able to afford any schooling, you could certainly make subsidies available for low-income people.
Pell grants for kindergartners.
Right. You know, I guess the only question then is whether or not you could keep education a compulsory program, and there are, I think, all 50 states have compulsory education laws. Tom Tancredo, a new member of Congress, elected from one of my home cities, Denver, Colorado, I think just has initiated a program to abolish compulsory education, so that might be a solution. But I think that's actually a somewhat radical solution. I might not be willing to go there as a first step, but it certainly is not one that I would reject out of hand as an ultimate solution. Last question, because it's almost 2:30.
Yes. Can I go back to your concerns about affirmative action on a higher education level? I was on the State Board of Education in Michigan for several years, and there was great concern not only about getting the youngsters in, the minorities into the colleges, but retention and expulsion and dropouts, etc. I tried many, many times to find out if they had statistics on the retention of the public school students as versus the non-public school minority students. They'd never give it to me. They would avoid the question. And because I know that usually about 94%, particularly of Catholic school, high school kids, make it to college. And I always wondered what the retention rate, you know.
Once they're in college.
Once they're in college, but as I said, they never wanted to give it to me.
Well,
I know which side of the fence I was on. And I wondered if you've been able to get any figures.
I haven't, but I would be happy if you want to, I'll give you one of my cards, and I'd be happy to have one of our two staff lawyers give you some language that you could use to draft a letter and demand the information. Believe me, under Freedom of Information laws, they are required to give you the kind of data, if they in fact can. If on their data collection there is a notation for public versus private and they have that data easily collectible, then they have to turn it over to you. You have a right to it, and I'll give you my card before I leave. Thank you all very much.